Last time, we were beginning to discuss switch implementation. So, given some converter, in order to figure out how to implement these ideal switches with semiconductor devices, we first took all of the switches in the converter, made them single pole, single throw switches, and then we started to analyze what are the required capabilities of the switch. What polarities of voltages does it need to block? What polarities of current does it need to conduct? And this dictates how we can implement this as a semiconductor device. Okay. So when I say it needs to block positive and negative voltages, my switch needs to be able to remain off regardless of the voltage polarity that I apply. It needs to conduct positive and negative current, needs to be able to stay on and conduct current in either direction. So things like a diode cannot remain off with both polarities of voltage, cannot conduct both polarities of current. Right. So went through a couple of them, mainly diodes and transistors, and then looked at a quick example at the end of class of how to implement switches in the buck converter. Here we went through and looked at these two now single pole, single throw switches. VA, when we looked at the off state voltage, it was just VG, the input voltage, always greater than zero. Ion was the inductor current. Inductor current, for some arbitrary topology, we wouldn't know, is that positive, negative, or could be either. So we solve out, replace IL with an expression in terms of things we do know the polarity and value of. So D we know is between 0 and 1. R and VG are both greater than zero. This whole expression has to be greater than zero. Now this switch blocks positive voltage and conducts positive current. So this is a single quadrant switch and can be any type of transistor. Okay. For switch B, did the same process, found it was again a single quadrant switch, but did not have positive current and positive voltage, instead had positive current, negative voltage. A single quadrant switch with these two flips, that looks like a diode. So our eventual implementation had one transistor, one diode. Important thing, any power converter topology that we're going to look at needs to have at least one active switch. So if you go through and solve and say everything's diodes, you got something wrong, because then I have no control over the circuit. I can't set a duty cycle. I'd have no ability to control the output. And you've got just some form of rectifier, passive rectifier. But in order to control, I need to have at least one thing that has a gate signal that can control it. Okay. Any questions on switch implementation up to here before we move on? Not, there's a couple more things we want to look at in semiconductor devices. So we looked at transistors and diodes, looking at them largely as single quadrant devices. We move into two quadrant devices. So if we want bidirectional current, in this case, being able to conduct current that is positive or negative, but keeping only positive off-state voltage, one way to implement that is a transistor with an anti-parallel diode. So this thing can only block positive voltage. If I try to apply negative, the diode will forward bias and it'll turn on. But it can conduct current in either direction. Current going down will go through the BJT. Going up will go through the diode. This is now a two-quadrant device that's current bidirectional. Next. So in the book, I've mentioned that we don't really use BJTs very often. In the book, they use BJTs in this chapter quite a bit in their diagrams, because they want to talk about a transistor as a single quadrant device. The reason they don't sketch them as MOSFETs is because a MOSFET itself is going to inherently be a current bidirectional device because it has this internal body diode. The way we use a MOSFET You may recall a MOSFET is a four-terminal device. More general sketch of an NMOS. I have gate, drain, source, and body. We're implementing these in power converters, these big power MOSFETs. They are a whole die dedicated to a single MOSFET. It's not like your microelectronics where I have these lateral devices and I have thousands of them on a single die. One big piece of silicon that's just one MOSFET, and we tie the body always down to source on this thing. There's no conflict with that because we don't have multiple devices on the chip. That effectively puts an internal diode here that we can't avoid on this MOSFET. So back here at the BJT, this is two things. This is, I took a BJT, and then I put a diode in parallel, two devices. With the MOSFET, this thing is one device. No matter what I do, this is connected as a three-terminal device. It's going to have this internal body diode. Generally, when these are made, we'll get into semiconductor cross-sections in a class or two for MOSFETs, looking at where this body diode comes from, how to design them. But speaking broadly at the moment, when this MOSFET is made, the manufacturers are designing it, and they're trying to make it be a really good MOSFET. Okay. Makes sense. So sometimes this body diode is somewhat parasitic. They're not optimizing for the body diode. If you want a good diode, they sell good diodes. If you want a good MOSFET, they sell good MOSFETs. And occasionally, the decisions to make this MOSFET be low resistance and fast switching cause the diode to be somewhat poorly behaved. Okay. So this is a circuit the book talks about in preventing that body diode from conduction if that body diode is a bad diode and we have a very high forward voltage that would result in a lot of conduction loss. So this is now my one MOSFET device, and I can put two external diodes here. This one forces the MOSFET to only conduct current kind of in this downward direction. And this is some better diode that I bought. It has a much lower forward voltage, and allow current in the negative direction to flow through this path instead. Okay. Cool thing I would say is somewhat outdated. More of a relic from the past, and we had a hard time controlling MOSFET. Now, rather than doing this, in most cases, a preferable solution is to do a better job in your precision on controlling this MOSFET, because the MOSFET itself can conduct current in either direction. So this is one thing, but internal to it, any current flowing in the upward direction can flow through two different paths. If the MOSFET is on, if my VGS is driven much greater than threshold, the current can flow through the channel of the device. If it's off, current can still flow through this body diode path. If it flows through the channel, it'll see R on. If it flows through the body diode, it'll see VD plus RD. Normal body diode drop. So rather than putting extra diodes in series and having to deal with the conduction loss of extra elements, preferable to just whenever you have current going in the upward direction, make sure the gate's on so it's conducting through the channel. Okay. So this somewhat rarely done nowadays. Not completely obsolete, but unlikely to see it in most cases. Is that clear? Something I find students are sometimes confused on. So if the gate's on, the current's going to go through the channel, goes through the MOSFET. Okay? Not true in a BJT, not true in an IGBT. They cannot conduct current in the negative direction. It has to go through the anti-parallel diode. But a MOSFET can. You can push it through the channel. Okay. And so back to my original comment, that's why a lot of things are drawn with BJTs in this chapter, even though we don't use them anymore in power electronics. is because it makes this a little nicer. You can think of these as two separate things. This is a single quadrant device. This is a single quadrant device. You put them together and you get a two quadrant device. With the MOSFET, it's a bit more nuanced because, you know, this thing's kind of two channel. It depends on how, or kind of two quadrant, depends on if you control it right. Then beyond these, when we start to look at voltage bidirectional two quadrant switches, so something that I want to conduct positive current would be able to block positive or negative voltage. Easy way to do that is a transistor in series with a diode. Now this, because the diode can only conduct current in this direction, but if I apply positive voltage like this, it'll be blocked collector to emitter on this transistor. If I apply negative voltage, V less than zero, it'll be blocked by the diode. Okay. Kind of comments over here on the right are taken from the book. They mention SCRs, other thyristor type devices. We won't cover in this class. We'll focus on transistors and diodes. They're very big power, slow switching things. We're not going to get into that. Okay, last full four quadrant switches. So an ideal switch is a four quadrant switch, doesn't care polarities of voltages or currents. Stay off when it's off and stay on when it's on, regardless of waveforms of voltages and currents. Ways to implement that. Essentially, here we've got two voltage bidirectional switches in anti-parallel to allow current to go either direction. Okay. So what we just looked at, here's my voltage bidirectional switch that conduct current in this direction. So now I've got a voltage bidirectional switch that can conduct current down and another one in parallel that can conduct current up. So this can now block both polarities of voltage and conduct both polarities of current. Here, kind of the dual of that, this is a current bidirectional with voltage unidirectional two quadrant switch. I put two of them in series, now I get four quadrants. And this thing, like a full bridge with a switch in the middle, is another way of implementing this. Kind of qualitatively at a higher level, we try to implement most things with just transistors and diodes. Occasionally, we'll need one of these two things because a certain topology requires a two quadrant switch. Excuse me, not these things. I'm kind of referring to this and this. We'll need a two quadrant switch, but we rarely end up using things that require a four quadrant switch. Right? Often, we can find some other way to implement the circuit, or it's just not competitive because of the additional losses of this type of thing. So here, I'm always going through two diodes. The additional conduction loss of going through all these diodes may kill me. Here, I have to do a lot of weird things with gate drive circuits in order to drive the bases of these devices. So four quadrant switches is a little bit more rare. If the specific topology was great and it needed a four quadrant switch, would be a limiting factor, but it'd be something to take into consideration when you're designing this thing. It's going to be a lot higher loss than just an individual transistor would be for the same current. But more diode drops, more conduction losses. Okay, last comment here is a thing that's commonly done. So I mentioned at the beginning that you can always implement a switch with a higher quadrant switch. A single quadrant switch, I can always use a two quadrant switch to implement it. It's just providing capabilities I don't need, right? Something only blocks positive voltage and I implement it with a switch that can block positive and negative, it's gonna work. I'm just doing something I didn't need. One case that we do this a fair amount in converters is replacing a diode with a MOSFET. Like I just said, it's drawn. upside down here, but this thing's a current bidirectional two quadrant switch. And if I could have used the diode, it's only a single quadrant switch required. But the benefit here we've mentioned before is that I go from a VED type of loss, a fixed voltage source, to an R-on type of loss. And again, so this would be power is VD times whatever current goes through it. Here the power is I squared times R on if I conduct through the channel of the MOSFET. And for a wide range of powers, VD times I is going to be greater than I squared R on. So I get to very large currents in most cases. This type of power loss, type of conduction loss, is going to be smaller than this. Okay. And so again, that depends on how I control this thing. So if it could have been a diode, that means that the current is always in this direction. It never goes negative. It means that the current in the MOSFET is always going to be source to drain. And so if I don't turn the gate on, then I'm just going to conduct through a body diode and it's no different, still a diode. But if I do turn the gate on, then I can conduct through the channel and get this I squared R on loss. So if the diodes are similar, I can actually get both of these characteristics with the MOSFET. I can kind of conduct through the channel to here and then let it go through the body diodes. Losses through the channel get too high. In fact, it'll inherently do that. If I put my I times R voltage, it's high enough to forward bias the diode, the current will automatically start going through the diode. Gives you a little bit of the best of both worlds, assuming that the behavior of this body diode is comparable to whatever discrete diode you could get, which may not be true. Okay. So anything that can be implemented with a diode, we can put a transistor instead. Come back here on this buck converter instead of this diode. We can put another transistor. Maybe get some slightly reduced conduction losses. Okay. All comes down to your application, where you are and what your MOSFET is. Okay. So, well, with this type of behavior, without picking a VD and an R on, this is just some cartoon of what the general behavior would be. You know, maybe I get a diode that has very low VD, something like 0.3 volts with a silicon Schottky, and then I get a 5 ohm MOSFET. The curve would look like this. It would be better as long as the current's less than a milliamp, just not so useful, right? Or I can get a 1 milliohm MOSFET and a, you know, 2 volt high voltage diode, and it's going to be better out to 10,000 amps. Don't go back in the recording and check my numbers there. Throwing things out. Okay. So it depends on what the currents that need to go through it are and kind of what devices you have available to you. So you're always going to see this kind of curve, but at this point, whatever IX is, where there's a break point that the diode becomes better, depends on the actual values of things. So this will, it becomes something to consider when you're in higher voltage converters. I've got 600 volts, that diode drops relatively small relative to my 600 volt input. I maybe only have a few amps to get kilowatts of power. And then maybe it's comparable, or really the losses of both of these are so small that I don't care relative to my kilowatts of power. Maybe I just stick with the diode. And that's something lower voltage, a power supply for a processor and a computer, where I've got 300 amps at 1.5 volts. There's no way I'm putting a diode in that thing. 1.5 volts out. If I put a diode in series and the diode has 1 volt of drop, my efficiency is 60% max. Got to be all MOSFETs conducting all the way through. Okay. Any other questions about device implementation? Okay, if not, what I'm going to move into is a little bit of discussion about switching losses and a little bit more practical discussion of losses in converters. I'm going to go a little bit beyond what the book does, kind of mention switching losses. I think a little bit more exposure to that's important. They're really a critical thing in practical design of power converters. I'm going to do it through an example application that I'll give a quick background on. So what I'm going to talk about is this 48-volt electric vehicle system. This is kind of an up-and-coming technology. So when you look at modern vehicles, right now most vehicles have this 12-volt bus, right? You've got a 12-volt lead-acid battery in your car. That powers a whole lot of systems on there. From the kind of inception of the automobile, this 12 volts helped out with things like ignition, powers your spark plugs, helps you get some cold crank, and powers your starter to get the engine going. Eventually lights, other things. As time has gone on, we've been pulling more and more power from this. Time versus the power on this low voltage bus, 12 volts. We start adding compressors for AC, we start adding a lot of electronics in your center stack, your radios, your GPS. More recently, we're moving to a lot more electrified systems on the vehicle, things like steering and going towards drive-by-wire rather than a mechanical system. So we have an electrical system that translates from the steering wheel to moving the wheels. Electrified suspension, looking at things like electrified superchargers, turbochargers, electrified, more intelligently electrified starters, actually putting an electric machine in there rather than just the starters of old. So the result of this has been a huge increase in power being pulled from this 12 volt bus. Okay. This curve is kind of a cartoon. I took it from some reference here, but I don't think this is the actual trend. It'd be a little bit less perfectly exponential. If we looked at it, it'd be kind of a whole lot here around the 70s. We added AC and other things, and then a little bit less before that. But today, we're somewhere around modern design is kind of the 2 to 3 kilowatt range, roughly, what we're pulling from this 12-volt bus, and that's only going to increase as more things get electrified. So what's the problem with that? When I start talking about things on the order of 10 kilowatts coming from 12 volts, that's, what, 800 amps, 850 amps? Approximately. That's a lot of current, okay? And to be able to conduct that much current without a voltage drop that is 12 volts and eliminate the entire voltage, I need cables that are huge and thick. I need a whole lot of copper to get the resistance down, right? So the weight of routing this 12 volts around a vehicle is becoming a problem, the cost of all that copper and the losses in it. So what they're looking at today is, why not push this up, right? So if I go from 12 volts to a higher voltage, I get the current down for the same power, right? It's going to require more power electronics because everything that's 12 volts, I need to step back down, but I can eliminate a whole lot of weight and cost in cable harnessing, okay? So when you look at how high to make this, basically from the argument I just made, higher is better. You say, make it 1,000 volts. 1,000 volts, one, the power electronics are going to be harder to go from 1,000 to 12. When we looked at the boost converter efficiency curves, it has a hard time when the conversion ratio gets really large. I don't want to make it that far away. Also, there's a whole lot of safety hazards there. I start adding 1,000 volt buses that connect to all of the, you know, radios in your car. That's a big safety concern. So what they're looking at is moving towards 48 volt bus and vehicles, really in both electric vehicles and non-electric and more conventional vehicles, because they still have all these electronic loads, even if it's not an actual electrified powertrain. Okay? The reason for that is standards for shock hazards start to come into play around 60 volts. So they're pushing up as high as they can while leaving some margins. They're not hitting 60 volts and having to make sure that it's all shock hazard compliant. The idea behind this is I take my conventional vehicle, I'd have my 12 volt bus down here that feeds a bunch of microelectronic loads, your radio, your center stack, some of the computers on board. Then I'd have a DC to DC between this and a 48 volt system that has a lot of the higher power loads. Okay. Things like a 48 volt starter generator, an actual electric machine that spins the engine to get it going. Things like turbos and supers that are electrified, power steering, AC compressor. These compressors are machines that benefit some from a higher voltage, so I'd have a lot of my higher power loads up here. Okay. This is not just some pie in the sky thing. It's been looked at by many companies. Audi has some kind of marketing slides where they talk about what their future vehicles are going to look like, and they're going to have this combined 48-volt system and 12-volt system running throughout the car. Mercedes-Benz is now releasing cars with 48-volt wiring. So their S500 has 48-volt bus in it to accommodate these things. Okay. So all of that is motivation for why I'm going to design this converter. Okay. So what we're going to look at is designing a 12-volt to 48-volt converter that could go between these two buses. So I keep my 12-volt lead-acid battery, I add the 48-volt bus. I need some ability to share power between them. Okay. So we're going to design a converter here that has 12 volts at the input, 48 at the output. And looking at a load of 48 ohms, output power, Vout squared over R, 48 squared over 48 is 48 watts. Okay. So this would not be supplying the entire 48 volt bus, it would just be some local converter that maybe supplies one load. Okay. So I'm going to use a boost in this case, most simple way to get my step up here of 4x. For a boost, my conversion ratio, let's just look at ideal analysis. Not worrying about any losses for the moment, we'll get there in a second. V over VG is 1 over D prime for the boost. So V over VG is 4, 1 over D prime. The D prime is a quarter, D is 0.75. And then part of my spec here, I want the output ripple to be less than 0.1 volts. So what's that going to tell me? On the boost converter, let's see, you can pick which subinterval we want to talk about. If I talk about subinterval 1, the diode's off. So the capacitor current is just the load current that happens for DTS. I can say 2 delta VC is equal to load current, V over R divided by capacitance times the time. So my delta VC is V over R, and let's write it, over 2C times DTS. I know what my ripple should be. What that's going to tell me is D looks like a triangle, doesn't it? I know what my duty cycle is, my ideal analysis. I know V over R. What I don't know is C and TS at the moment. So I'm going to get some relationship between those two. I just solve for capacitance. Capacitance is equal to what? V over R is 1. 2, put the delta VC down here, that's 0.1. D is 3/4. I'd have 1 over 2 times 1/10 times 0.75 times TS. D is equal to 30 over 8 times TS. Without knowing one of those, I can't size this capacitor yet. But I see this relationship that we understand now. I either need to switch faster or have more capacitance to get the ripple down. Right? Mistake there. Okay, so if I want to design this thing, how do I do it? How do I select what the MOSFET should be in diodes and inductors? Okay. Well, I haven't taught you that yet. You can maybe puzzle it out based on knowing loss mechanisms and work with some of these things. For the moment, what I'm going to do is I'm going to let somebody else do the work. So I went to ti.com, used their Webbench tool, typed in all my specs, and it spits this thing out and tells me, here's your converter design. And it's got some kind of cool stuff on their website. So it designed it for me, and it told me FS is 200 kilohertz. Okay, so it's giving me a schematic for everything. What is all this stuff? Okay, so everything down here is one of their chips that they want to sell me that does all of the control and then some passives to set up how to do it. This is in large part stuff we haven't talked about yet. This is the feedback loop. It senses the output voltage, feeds it back to an internal amplifier with some kind of feedback network that does all of my closed loop stabilization. When it comes up, it's got gate drivers in here. They're going to drive the gates of the MOSFET, some other passives related to protection and startup setting frequency and other things. So not too worried about this stuff at the moment. Really just want to look at the power stage. Okay. So it picked for me an inductor and gave me a part number. The inductor is 22 microhenries. Gave me a diode. Says about 0.69 volts forward voltage. Gave me an output capacitor of 22 microfarads. Parallel with a 1 microfarad, so maybe 23 microfarads total. And then for the MOSFETs, what it did is it picked a MOSFET and put two in parallel. And this is just to get the on resistance down, right? So if I put two of these directly in parallel, drive the gate to source the exact same, they both turn on at the same time, I'll effectively get two R-ons in parallel or half the on resistance out of this device. So it was trying to give me high efficiency, so put two of these in parallel to get the MOSFET conduction losses down. Okay, so we can go back and check. FS is 200 kilohertz. I know that now. If I go back and look at my capacitor required and plug in here, switching period is 1 over 200 kilohertz. This comes out to be 18.6 microfarads at 200 kilohertz. Here they gave me 23 microfarads, a little bit bigger than required based on commercially available parts, but being bigger means my voltage ripple will be smaller than my spec. So that part will work. Okay. What else do we want to talk about? We'll loop back to some other things. So now that I have all these parts, I'd like to figure out, well, what efficiency can I expect out of this thing? How's it going to work? Okay. So I have parts for my inductor, my MOSFETs, and my diode, but I want to incorporate those into my loss modeling that we've done so far, so I need to know Ron, CD, RD, RL, these parameters. So I go and I look up the data sheets of these individual parts and pull select plots for each of these parts. Here's a plot of my instantaneous forward voltage and forward current for the diode, current versus on resistance for the MOSFET, and the inductors, they just give me a table of a lot of different parts. The inductor is the easiest. This is the one that was selected for me. DCR stands for DC resistance, given in milliohms. So the one I had here was 1.86. My RL is going to be 1.86 milliohms. Okay. MOSFET, a little bit more nuanced. So this is showing is Ron versus current for curves of VGS. Okay. These might be hard to see. It goes 3.2 volts to 5 volts, then 6, then 10. You see, I drive this thing and I back like a microelectronics device and I go to kind of a low voltage, a little bit above threshold. My Ron is just going to skyrocket. This thing's really not in a deep triode operating mode that makes it look like a resistance, more like a current source. See my effective resistance of that skyrocketing and my loss is going up. I drive this thing all the way up to 10 volts VGS. Then I get a nice flat constant on resistance out of it across the range of current. So I'm going to want to be here, maybe somewhere in between these two. I don't plan on taking this thing up to 200 amps in my application, right? 48 watts. I've got 4 amps at the input, 1 amp at the output. So maybe I'm okay with a little bit of increase and using 6 volts. But to be safe, let's call it 10 volts. So I'll drive VGS is 10. Then my on resistance here of one device is 8 milliohms. I have 2 in parallel. So in my model, I'll call Ron 4 milliohms, resistance of the two of them in parallel, cut in half if they're matched, right? Okay, diode, generally give this log plot, and the y-axis is log scale, showing voltage versus current. So if I want to model this as a diode voltage plus the resistance, the voltage is going to be the value that this curve crosses, kind of the minimum here. If I put even 100 milliamps through it, I get some fixed minimum voltage. Then the resistance is going to be the slope of the line going up from that. The resistance then for every bit of additional current, how much does the voltage go up proportionally? Okay. This plot shows three curves, 25, 100, and 175 degrees C operating temperature. So we'll just look at the 25 degrees C, the room temperature, for the moment. Depending on where this is mounted in the car, that may be fair, it may be not. Somewhere in the cabin, probably fair. Near the engine, probably 100 degrees is more realistic. I'm less concerned about that. I do want to point out the trend here. So this direction is increasing temperature. And as I increase temperature, for the same current, the voltage of the diode drops, right? That means conduction losses are going to go down. Increased temperature, my conduction losses drop. This has to do with this diode being a minority carrier device, and as it gets hotter, there's more minority carriers available to conduct current. So the conduction losses go down. Get into that a little bit more later. But the important thing to think about is that's maybe not a favorable behavior. So it means if my diode is very lossy and it's heating up, then it's going to generate less loss, and it's going to continue kind of taking a lot of current. The area where this comes into play is with a MOSFET, that's not the case. I put two MOSFETs in parallel like I did in this converter. MOSFET, as it gets higher conduction losses, as it gets higher temperature, conduction losses get worse. So if I have these two and for some reason one of them is taking too much current, they're not sharing the current equally, that one will get hotter, bond resistance will go up, and then more current will go back to the other one and they'll kind of passively share current very well. Diodes, that's not the case. I put two diodes in parallel, one of them takes too much current, it gets hotter, and then its impedance goes down, so it'll take even more current. And eventually these things will run away and just one of my diodes will take all of the current. Could be a problem, could heat up and explode if I've designed this thing such that I assume the two of them share current. So diodes, not good at sharing current when parallel. MOSFETs, they're fine. Okay. So if I want to model this, I just have a single diode in this case. So I'm going to use this 25 degree C curve. My VD is here, about 0.65 volts. And then my resistance is going to be the slope of this line. My delta V over delta I, so as the current increases, what's the proportional relationship between voltage and current? Looking at this from here to here is about an amp increase. From here to here is about a volt increase. I'll say this is about, from here to here is 0.1 volts increase, 0.1 volts over 1 amp. So RD, 0.1 ohms. Okay, so these are the things I'm going to plug into my loss model, see if I can predict the efficiency of this converter. Before I do that, one thing I want to look at is how do I expect this thing to behave? Okay. I want to look at a few waveforms in this converter. Probably next class now, go in and simulate this thing. I want to, before I simulate it, think about what I expect to see out of that simulation. Okay. So waveforms I like to look at a lot in power converters: inductor current, switch node voltage, are generally two things as you're testing converters that are easy to measure and give you some insight as to what's going on. Okay. Plot these things, my switch node voltage. I'll call that the drain to source of the MOSFET in the case of the boost converter, but it's the voltage that's PWMing, call it the switch to node. Right? Look at my inductor current. And the other thing I'm going to look at is my MOSFET current here. Call it I1 for the current through drain to source of Q1. Right? So switch node voltage from 0 to DTS. In the boost converter, that's subinterval 1. It's when the MOSFET itself is on, so my switch node voltage will be down here at 0 in ideal analysis. Device is on. When I shut it off, it'll jump up here. The diode will turn on, and the voltage at this node should go to V. My inductor current will be steady around some value, capital IL, and have some ripple around that that increases during subinterval 1, decreases during subinterval 2, value delta IL. Solve out, both of these things are my ideal analysis. Okay, so the inductor current I remember from Loose Converter, IL is C over R D prime. Is that right? Yeah. That in this case is 1 over 0.25 or 4 amps. My delta IL in subinterval 1, the device is on, so I've got VG across the inductor. So 2 delta IL is equal to VG over L times DTS. I plug in and solve here, delta IL is 1 amp at my 200 kilohertz. Okay, not extremely small ripple, but maybe that's what I get for letting TI do my work for me. Last thing I want to look at, this I1 current through the transistor. Well, that's going to look like the inductor current when it's on and zero when it's off, right? That should be the same kind of thing, and then zero. During this time, it's IL. During this time, it's zero. Maybe for fun, I'll add one more. What about the diode current? Called ID. I'll plot that here in blue. Well, that's just the rest of the inductor current, right? So the inductor current either goes through the MOSFET if it's on, or the diode if it's not. So the diode current will look like this. Okay. If I want to make my small ripple approximation, the tops of these are flat, and IL is just its DC value. Sketching it with the ripple in there, just to get a little closer to what we'd expect to see in simulation. All good there? Yeah.
With the bidirectional MOSFET, the current you were talking about earlier, does that apply at all to the scenario?
So it doesn't. I mean, that MOSFET still could conduct negative current. At the operating point I'm talking about with 4 amps DC and 1 amp ripple, the minimum current here is going to be 3 amps. So the MOSFET's going to conduct something that goes from 3 to 5 amps and then shuts off. So because of the operation of the converter, it never needs to conduct negative current. Now, in this case, never really could, right? If I tried to make the inductor current go negative, it could go negative through the MOSFET, and then as soon as I shut the MOSFET off, it can't go through the diode. So I never really have an operating mode where I have significant negative current that would make sense in this topology. There are somewhat more nuanced reasons why I might want to have negative current. And then if I switch that diode out for a MOSFET, like I talked about, to make both of my switches current bidirectional, then, well, a less nuanced reason, a straightforward reason is this thing can flow power either direction. And that may actually be useful in the application we're talking about. If I'm going between a 48-volt and a 12-volt bus, and they both have batteries, maybe I want to let power go either direction. Both of these things are a MOSFET, so when power goes that way, it's a buck. When power goes that way, it's a boost. I can do either. As it is with the diode, I can only flow power this way. Try to pull power back. The diode will block that negative current. Make sense? So here, no, we're not really using it. It just had to be a MOSFET because it was single quadrant with both voltage and current positive. You know, diode single quadrant, that thing couldn't have been a diode because diode is positive voltage, negative current, opposite polarity, single quadrant. Could have been a BJT, but like I said, BJTs are bad. Don't do a good job. Okay, so we know what we expect. Next class, look at doing our equivalent circuit model, and then see if that matches the behavior that we get out of this thing, and talk about reasons why it may not. Okay? There'll be a homework through Friday. It's office hours this afternoon. Let me know if you have any questions. Thanks, guys.